Hello, hello. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Miss Sarah Gon. Sarah, how are you doing?
Well, thank you. Nice day.
Yes, it is. And Mr. Becky Machlobo. Becky, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, man. Thank you for having me, Nick. And hi, Sarah.
Hi, Becky. Nice to see you.
Yeah, always good to have you with us, Becky. Right. So I think the big thing making we're gonna do something slightly different on the show today. We're gonna start off with a foreign news story, and this is of course the story that I think has been covered most around the world, and that is a big flare up in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which there's been a lot of videos and footage and photos and stuff coming out of the rocket fire and the anti-rocket missiles and the airstrikes and all the sort of trauma that's going on. I must say that in sort of difficult and trying times as this, when people are getting killed, I do take delight in when you see things that kind of lighten the mood a bit. And I did see a video of it's an Israeli guy, he's filming on the street, and then there's an explosion from a rocket nearby, and him and everyone else run inside, and then they pop out their heads again because they see that there's no danger anymore, and they go out into the street. There's a huge fire raging where the rocket hit. And the entire time, there was a guy eating a kebab who just sat at the table and didn't move through the entire rocket explosion or anything, just sort of looking casually to the side as he watches the flames engulfing a building. So I wish that was the only part of the story, but unfortunately, it looks like around 50 people have been killed in the fighting so far, and there are fears that some people are saying it could devolve into another full-scale war between Israel and Palestine. Palestinian militants, mostly the group Hamas, but also Palestinian Jihad, have launched 1,000 rockets since Monday, as well as launching an anti-tank missile at some Israeli troops who they killed. The rockets have killed people, and in retaliation, the Israelis carried out airstrikes on any what they thought to be Hamas positions, which have killed at least 43 people. And the Palestinians also claim that among those 43 were 13 children. So there is a lot of tension here. The background to this is that the Palestinian Authority, which is a different group to Hamas and controls the West Bank, whereas Hamas controls Gaza, were scheduled to have elections. But the president of the Palestinian Authority, some suspect because he feared losing those elections, canceled them. And this is one of the things that is perhaps driving this conflict. But there's a lot of others as well, which I think Sarah will get into here. Also, at the same time, Israel's going through a bit of a political crisis in that it's had, I think, 5 elections or something in the past couple of years, 4 elections in the past couple of years,
yes,
because they've been unable to form a government, mostly due to the fact that Israeli society is very polarized about Bibi Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister's role in the country's politics and whether he should continue to serve as the prime minister. So he's currently a caretaker president, prime minister,
yeah.
And he declared a state of emergency very recently in relation to these rocket attacks. Sarah, what's your take on this latest outbreak of violence? What are the other reasons behind it? What's going on here?
The general narrative that comes out from the Palestinian side and for much of the mainstream media in the West is that basically the Israeli police attacked peaceful protesters and they again treated Palestinians terribly, etc., etc. And it's more like this. During Ramadan, there are always or almost invariably protests of some kind during the period of the month. And during the period of Ramadan, there have been protests flaring up in East Jerusalem, and the People's Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which sounds a bit like Monty Python, has been lobbing sort of relatively small rockets on an ongoing basis into Israel, as opposed to try and up the ante. And then as it go towards the end of Ramadan, the protests increase. The protests invariably get aggressive and violent, and the police have to go in and tackle them. There were fireworks, there were burning trees, etc. And in reality, that is no different to the way any country would handle violent protests with their police forces. But in the case of Israel, the narrative is always that they are dastardly about it. And then it really got heated over a so-called property dispute in East Jerusalem, where the Palestinians claimed that Palestinians were being forced off their land. And what in fact it is a piece of land that was purchased by Jews in the 1870s. It was always Jewish land. It was then the Ottoman Empire. Once they purchased it, it was theirs. And they were dispossessed of the land when Jordan occupied the West Bank and Jerusalem from 48 to 67. And once the Israelis took it back, or took it in 67, the Jews essentially moved back, and they have proof of ownership. And it's quite a complex story that goes on and on, but essentially there was an agreement that that land, being in East Jerusalem, would be rented by Arabs, by Palestinians. And what's happened is that they haven't paid their rents. This has gone to court, and it was about to go to the Supreme Court when it was used to turn it into a real conflagration and real riots and real responses. And then Hamas, which, as you say, governs Gaza, started lobbing rockets. And the reason it gave, and this will give you some idea of what sort of narratives one's dealing with, the reason they gave for it was to protect Palestinian lives in Jerusalem. Now, if you know anything about where East Jerusalem is in relation to anywhere else in Israel, any rocket, if it had landed Jerusalem, would as likely kill Palestinians as it would kill Israelis. So not a really interesting reason. And then Hamas got serious and started lobbing rockets into Israel that have a longer reach than rockets previously, which confirms the information that Iran has been increasingly arming Hamas. So, in other words, rockets are getting closer to the big cities, and now people are dying. And when that happens, the Israelis give not a shit, and they are going to launch reprisals, and they're going to try and take out the Hamas leadership. So it's that situation we're in. And if there's one thing the Israelis are serious about, is if Israelis start getting killed, the war will intensify. Now, Hamas is now saying, we will up the ante, but we are ready to talk, which means they're ready to talk. But all that what happens is it goes from one ceasefire over a period of years to another ceasefire, and this carries on and on. What I find really worrying, other than the fact that the narrative is so unbalanced, is the fact that the West doesn't seem to really accept that when Iran says it wants to destroy Israel, it actually means what it says. I mean, Iran is not a neighbor of Israel's. Israel is no immediate threat to Iran, but it's been arming Hezbollah, so the Syrians, and Hamas increasingly. And the reason the Iranians want to go to war with Israel is because it's a religious tenet that they remove Jews from the Middle East. It's I know it sounds really weird, like the West would never dream of it, but it is really a religious foundation for their involvement. So the risk of conflagration is great. And of course, there's also the political dynamic as to whether Hamas will make the PA look bad for the reasons you gave of Abbas now going into his 17th year of his four-year term. But it could go the other way, and Abbas may be relying on Hamas to be a bit hammered to strengthen its position in the elections. So it really takes electioneering to another level.
So I will push back a little bit on the Iran religious aspect that you brought up there to modify it slightly and say that I think, while obviously religious fundamentalism is very important to the Iranian government, I mean, they call themselves the Islamic Republic of Iran, that they have a very interesting ideology, which is kind of unique in the world, which sort of fuses fundamentalist Shiite 12 Islam with a kind of almost Marxist type revolutionary attitude about spreading the revolution to the whole world. And they also have in their minds a sort of Iranian Persian nationalism, which sees the Middle East as sort of natural Iranian sphere of influence. And so Israel, apart from being a sort of a religious and ideological enemy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is also the main power threatening Iran's domination of the Middle East. And the two countries have basically been at war now for a while in secret, mostly in Syria, where Iran has been, of course, supporting Israel's enemies. And the Israelis have been launching air strikes on Syrian and Iranian troops in Syria. And of course, Iran's nuclear program, which is currently in the midst of in development, has had lots of computer viruses and assassinations that have plagued it. So its top scientists have been assassinated. Its electrical systems have been sabotaged by viruses. And most of the time, it does seem like Israel is involved in these. So it's not terribly surprising that Iran is supporting Israel's opponents to an increasing degree in the Middle East. And this is, I think, a sign of the larger tensions in the Middle East between Israel, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia on one side, and Iran on the other. And I suspect that this conflict is just part of that escalation between the two sides.
I don't disagree with you. It's just that this has been Iran's position from the days of the revolution. And the Shia Sunni split is so antagonistic. It's actually it creates more antagonism than anything that Israel does or says. It's only recently that Israel has become that relatively powerful player in the Middle East.
Yeah. And that has changed a lot of dynamics.
Yeah. And I think they now feel if they can wipe out Israel, then it would diminish the Sunni side of the Middle East conflict.
Right, because most of the military power on the anti-Iranian side of the Middle East comes from Israel, because the Saudi army and the UAE's army are not particularly good quality, especially the Saudi army. It's really not good quality. So I think they're very terrified of Iran. Sara, I have a theory, and I'd like your thoughts on it, which is that another thing driving this conflict is actually the internal Palestinian conflict between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. Mm-hmm. Hamas is expected to win any elections that would be held in the West Bank of Palestine or of the Jordan River. And so I see that perhaps by launching these attacks, Hamas is trying to make the Palestinian Authority look weak and like a lapdog of Israel, so that they can perhaps overthrow it and then establish their control over the West Bank, as they have over Gaza as well. I mean, what's your take on this, Sara?
I think there's a lot to that. You see, I think there is a real risk that Abbas, the Palestinian, Fatah, would be beaten by Hamas. The problem that Abbas faces, and I mean, there isn't a day when a horribly anti-Semitic comment isn't made on PA media. The problem for Abbas is that the Israelis are not in the West Bank in Palestinian territory. They hold the security positions in what is called the occupied territories, but is actually disputed territories. The state of those territories hasn't been resolved. It was meant to be resolved by negotiation. But in reality, for Fatah, their existence depends on being protected by the Israelis. So if Hamas makes headway, the Fatah is probably dead.
Right. So it's a difficult position for them to be in. And so we're talking a bit about this in our media meeting this morning, it seems almost like it's kind of in everyone's interest for this to go on. I have an Israeli friend who told me of a conspiracy theory that Bibi Netanyahu is somehow behind this stuff, which I don't think has got any weight to it. But it's interesting that, you know, there's this political crisis essentially in the Palestinian territories and in Israel at the same time. And to a certain degree, it seems to kind of be in almost in anyone's interest to have this conflict right
just
now.
Last comment on that.
Sure, go ahead.
Isn't it funny that Israel's crisis is democratic and the PA's crisis is undemocratic?
Right. They are very different types of crises. One is just because no one can agree on who gets to be the prime minister. And the other one is a desperate fight for resources and control over land on the Palestinian side. But so, Becky, I want to get you in here. You told me before the show you're not a guy who follows this conflict terribly closely. But I want to get your take on what is your view of the way this is reported and talked about, and how you kind of look at it from someone who's, you know, a little bit on the outside of it. how does this whole debate strike you? It sort of seems strange. It's different to other geopolitical debates, isn't it?
Yeah, Nick. I think one of the major issues here is actually looking for honest coverage of the issue, because what I see mostly from the United States media coverage is that it's either Israel's fault or it's both of them. It's both of their fault. It's particularly interesting when I also watched this, according to the president, under Donald Trump. I remember when Donald Trump moved the embassy to Jerusalem, and everyone cried out loud and said there'll be conflict in the Middle East, there'll be increase in tensions, whereas I didn't particularly see that after that. And it's actually interesting how Joe Biden will handle this increasing conflict. So I will have to say that the media coverage of this has not been particularly on that honest. It's been biased. And unfortunately, it makes it quite hard for someone to actually find the truth as to what's really happening there in the Middle East.
Yeah, I think that's definitely correct. I mean, that's my impression of it. You know, I don't follow the conflict that closely, apart from the more geopolitical stuff in the Middle East, which I'm very interested in. And it's always just sort of such a mess. Whenever you read a news report, you kind of have to make sure which news site you're reading and how they normally interpret these events to try and get a picture of what's going on. It's not easy. But anyway, Sara, final thoughts on this topic from you.
Let's put it this way. Once rockets start flying and people start really dying as opposed to being injured, it gets ugly, but normally it comes to a head fairly quickly and a ceasefire is agreed. Whether the deeper involvement of Iran will change that in any way, I'm not entirely sure. But certainly, ironically, Mahmoud Abbas's worst nightmare is that Israel is badly affected by this, because he depends on them for his survival.
No, exactly. And the other thing to watch is going to be how the Biden administration responds to this, because, of course, in the United States, the Democratic Party is very torn over the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in a way that the Republican Party is not. The Republican Party is traditionally sort of pro-Israel, and that's kind of where the debate for the most part ends. But the Democrats have both pro-Israeli and anti-Israeli forces inside their party, and how Biden is now going to be faced with the real dilemma of, you know, how does he deal with this conflict? And I suspect the Americans are probably going to take the path of keeping quiet and keeping their heads down, precisely because Biden doesn't want to enrage either wing of his party.
Yeah. No, look, I think for the Republicans, it might be, they might consider it an opportunity to take the lead. It's certainly a lot less difficult for them than for the Democrats.
No, definitely. Anyway, interesting but tragic story, and hopefully a ceasefire is resumed soon. It is, of course, a long ongoing conflict, but the sooner rockets stop being fired, things will get, I think, a lot better in the short term. Anyway, let us move back home to South Africa to talk about what I think is quite a funny story in some ways. I don't know if you've heard of the German word Schadenfreude, I think it is. Mm-hmm. Now, my German-speaking colleagues, of whom we have a few, might correct me, but I believe it's to take delight in someone else's misfortune or embarrassment.
Correct.
I can't help but sometimes feel that way about the ANC's troubles with finances. You know, the party has had a lot of problems recently with its finances. There's talks now that the ANC is so bust that it's going to have to do a 50% cut of the party's staff, which is quite devastating. The ANC's new Secretary General, now that Ace Magashule has been suspended, Jesse Duarte, said that, no, we're not broke. We're just experiencing cash flow problems. She blamed the Political Party Funding Act for this, saying that ANC donors didn't want to publicly identify themselves as ANC donors. I'm not 100% sure whether that is really the reason, because as I'm sure you and Becky will remember, the ANC lost control of their finances a while ago, evidenced by the fact that the ANC no longer uses its original website, which was anc.org.za. After a dispute with its internet service provider, it was forced, or its domain holder, I can't remember which it was, it was forced to change the address of its website because the company claimed it hadn't paid its internet bills, which is fairly embarrassing, which is why the ANC's website is today anc1912.co.za. So that's a bit embarrassing for them. So the question really is, and Becky, I'll start with you on this. Is the ANC going to survive if they lose power? I mean, considering the state the party's organization is in, would they actually be able to hold together, do you think?
You know, looking at the internal battles of the ANC, it's actually quite an interesting party to have a look at. Usually, countries that have a government that is implicit in corruption, they take from public funds in order to finance themselves. But in this case, the ANC just takes money and doesn't put in its own organization itself. Not to say it should do that. Even this past weekend, what's also quite interesting is that we had the previous president of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, even questioned if there's an ANC. And that's actually quite telling. And on this particular point, I think it leaves the country at risk here. And the risk is that the ANC has essentially run off its own money and will look into ways to tap into other funds. Those funds may be that of private funds. That's why we're seeing push towards a nationalization of certain industries, as well as that of the banking sector. We've seen hostility towards the banking sector. And the reason why they're looking for private funds is that they've essentially run out of public funds. If you look at what's happening with South African finances in terms of what they receive in tax revenue in comparison to what they spend each year, which gives you a budget deficit, we're running budget deficits only eclipsed 3 times in South African history, 2 times in world wars, and the 3rd time at the end of our at the end of apartheid. So I think this is particularly telling. I think we're going to see more cases of corruption. We're going to see more cases of hostility towards the private sector because essentially the ANC has run out of money itself.
Right. Sarah, your thoughts as well on this? Do you agree with Becky's prediction there?
I think to add to that is the fact that having put out this idea that we must battle corruption from Ramaphosa, you've got the Zondo Commission, and with the Zondo Commission unearthing all sorts of slime left, right, and center, what's being exposed is the fact that the whole rationale behind cadre deployment is that the people who benefit from it will contribute back to the ANC. And what's happening is that less benefiting at the moment, not wanting to be seen to put money into the ANC. So the ANC is kind of stuck with no one wanting to come, you know, to give money to them. And they're literally, that's why they've run out of cash, because they've always been otherwise extremely well funded. So what they're relying on is the money given to it by the Independent Electoral Commission, which gives proportional amounts to all the parties in government. But they made the critical mistake of not paying PIYE over to the tax man. And we all know that the minute you piss the tax man off, you're in hiding to nowhere. And so what the SARS did is got the ANC to agree that it get a garnishing order against the money the IEC owes to it, or some of it, every month, to cover the PIYE payments that have not been made. So essentially what that means is that the IEC pays that agreed amount or that that order directly to SARS. It doesn't go through the ANC. Now, I'm not a financial expert, but I know that A, when you start with the revenue service, and B, when you repeatedly have continuous cash flow problems, eventually business goes bad completely.
So according to the Mail and Guardian, In December of 2019, Paul Mashatile, who I think is the treasurer of the ANC, had to apologize to the ANC staff because apparently their salaries were not paid before Christmas, and he blamed the late transfer of funds from donors. But that suggests that the party's in a very bad position if they needed to wait for a very specific donor transfer. The Mail and Guardian spin on this is also that Ramaphosa closed the taps to Lithuli House after it was alleged that Paul Mashatile and David Mabuza had pocketed funds intended for party coffers. Now, I mean, I don't know if that's true or not, but that is, you know, sort of the allegation here. So, yeah, Becky, I agree with you completely. It looks like even the money that you'd expect to go back to the party. I mean, that's the whole idea of a kickback, right? Is a political party favors someone and in return they give something back to the party. The ANC doesn't even seem to be doing corruption, right?
Not at all. And I think these are signs of actually change in the future. As much as it is a crisis within the ANC as well as in the country level, in times when governments run out of funds, it leaves room for change. There could be another political party that just takes up where the ANC left off, essentially, mainly because of the ANC's own doing. So as much as we are kind of pessimistic on this issue, it does offer a sense of optimism in the future.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Definitely. I think, as our CEO, Frans Cronje, says all the time, that a shift in South African politics is very possible at the moment. Anyway, let's go on to our final story, and we don't have long to cover this, only about 3 or 4 minutes. But there has been a comment made by the Small Business Development Minister, who said that the department is in talks with the Department of Trade and Industry and Competition to designate more products under the 100% local content category to support small, medium, and micro enterprises in the local manufacturing sector. There are also calls to reduce the number of imports we have to make South Africa, to favor South African businesses and basically shut out foreign competitors from the South African market. Tariffs, protectionism, restrictions on imports, these tend to be very popular policies. They were popular in the United States. They're popular in parts of the UK. They're very popular in Europe, in China. Becky, what's your take on this?
Unfortunately, it's another form of taxation on the South African consumer. And the idea behind this is that you restrict imports in order to support local businesses. And the idea behind that is that you incentivize employment in those industries, you incentivize South African consumers to buy products in those industries, which essentially gives money to those local South African industries. But what's not actually seen here is that the reason why South African consumers buy goods on an international scale is that those international companies produce those goods more efficiently and more cost and more cheaply compared to the local goods in South Africa. That's the sole reason why South Africans purchase those goods, because it's cheaper on their income levels. Now, when you restrict that and you force South African consumers to buy local at a more expensive price, it's another form of taxation. That means that money that could have been spent elsewhere has not been spent, and the employment in those industries has essentially been destroyed. And we don't see that, and the government does not see that. That's why this form of protectionism is so popular amongst government, because they see the increase in employment in these industries, they don't see the destruction in other industries. So that's the unfortunate part.
Sara, you had a great comment before the show on this idea. What was it you said? It's not just protectionism, it's...
Gosh, I can't remember.
It's not just protectionism, it's just stupid.
Well, I think, let me add my two cents with it. I think the problem is that none of the ministers, and least of all the small business minister, understand how businesses work, and that it is businesses who determine what they think the market wants or how they can establish a need. And therefore, they will buy from and they will purchase what they need from other suppliers and other businesses to create what they want. It's not just about protection. It's not just about not having competition from overseas. It's much more complex, and it's much more widely spread into society. And I don't think the government understands that at all. That if anyone understands what business needs to do for business, it's business, not government, and certainly not the Minister of Small Business and whatever she, whatever.
Right. And of course, famously, I think it was Nkrumah, who is the first leader of independent Ghana, tried an approach very similar to this. When, you know, he tried to build big steel manufactories and things in Ghana. And of course, they were all so expensive, they quickly became a drain on the fiscus and had to be shut down. So, you know, this is not a story that doesn't have precedent, and we really shouldn't be following in this path.
Yeah, just a last comment in there. The part that usually is missed by the ANC is that the people that really determine what should be bought, what should be produced or not, is that of the South African consumer. And this is another way in which government is trying to direct the actions of these South African consumers, which always leads to inefficiencies and so forth. And it actually speaks to the broader narrative that I see within the ANC, is to move towards centralization, central planning, in other words, which is always bad for the country.
Right, exactly. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. I will not be on the show tomorrow because I'm taking it off for my birthday, but Mr. Gabriel Krauser, the wise and venerable tall man himself, with an even greater beard than I, although that's a bit neat at the moment, has agreed to set in, to stand in for me, and so he'll be hosting the show tomorrow, but I'll be back on Monday next week. Anyway, thank you very much, everyone. Have a wonderful day, and keep that flag of liberty flying. Cheers, everyone.